Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Happy Black Friday, everyone. Don't get trampled at any superstores today. And this morning we will re-air some of our favorite recent conversations for this Friday after Thanksgiving.
When I interview these people and all they have is one change of clothes and they've told me the saddest story in the world and suddenly I feel so connected with them and there's not much that I can do but tell their story.
That's Brandon Stanton, best known for his photo blog, Humans of New York. He spent some time in Europe interviewing Syrian refugees earlier this year. So today, Brandon Stanton on Meeting Humans of New York and Humans of the World. And we have the rare opportunity to speak with a doctor from Doctors Without Borders who has worked in a combat zone and is now the president of Doctors Without Borders USA. These are incredible heroes and a hero to many in his own right. Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist and author. He'll talk about his new memoir, which traces his evolution from scientist to world-renowned atheist. Judd Apatow also has a new book. It's about comedy and life. We'll talk to him about both. And Anna Sale, the host of Death, Sex, Money, our podcast, discusses the gender dynamics of infidelity and the biology of cheating. But first, my interview with Cokey Roberts from back in May. The NPR and ABC News correspondent did some political analysis, like does the first potential female president matter when talking about Hillary Clinton anymore? And Cokey will talk about her new book, Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. Hi, Cokey. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Brian. What a treat to be with you, as always.
And congratulations on the book. You've had previous bestsellers like Founding Mothers and Ladies of Liberty. Why did you choose to focus on the Civil War era this time?
Because the publisher wanted a book on the Civil War.
Honest.
Yes, honest. It was the sesquicentennial, a hard word to say on the radio.
Means 150-year anniversary.
150-year anniversary, starting in 2011, going to 2015. And so they really were eager for a Civil War book, and I frankly never wanted to write a Civil War book. All of my ancestors were on the losing side, and it's a horrible war. And actually, the more I think about it, the more sort of angry I get, to tell you the truth, because there were more than 600,000 Americans killed. And it's such a failure of politics and statesmanship that you had to go to war to get emancipation. And Lincoln basically said that was true. He said it to Sojourner Truth. He said he couldn't have done what he did if the people across the river pointing to Virginia hadn't misbehaved. But it's a terrible indictment.
And it's a terrible, terrible war. People think war today is brutal, which it is, but you look back.
Oh, it was horrible.
At how people were lining up in rows face to face with each other practically and shooting each other.
And with rifles that were way too sophisticated for that kind of warfare. It was a horrible war.
So the first thing in the book is a quote by Clara Barton from 1888 in which she says, "Women advanced more than 50 years because of the Civil War over what they would have with continued peace." Is that the truth of the history you discovered?
Yes, it is. That is really the book. The book is how the Civil War changed Washington's place in the country and how it changed the place of women in American society. And, you know, I was fascinated because having grown up in Washington in post-World War II, seeing the parallels were just enormous, and they were both about the growth of the federal government and how Washington played a greater and greater role in American life, but also how women played a greater and greater role in Washington. So as in World War II, women came to Washington as government girls in the Civil War.
Government girls.
Yes,
what
government,
does that mean?
Well, that was in World War II, that was a well-known term of women who came in and worked in to staff the government agencies that cropped up as a result of the war. Same exact thing happened in the Civil War. Rosie the Riveter, women came in to work in the arsenals and had horrible experiences in some cases because it was very, very dangerous work. And women who were like Clara Barton, who came just to work in the government, ended up doing extraordinary things, founding the American Red Cross. And, you know, it drives me crazy, Brian, the way history books say that. You know, she founded the American Red Cross. Really? Was it hard? Did it require any effort?
Was you mean there anything like, give that me would... some detail yes, other than yeah. Clara Barton was a nurse?
Well, and also some, a supplier and the founder of the Missing Persons Bureau, and what she had to do in terms of the Red Cross was lobby Congress for 2 decades to get them to ratify the Geneva Conventions. And so, you know, you have a lot of activity here. But the political women, because of my day job and of my own upbringing, are the people who really interested me the most. And they are funny and fascinating and frank and feisty, but also their roles changed as a result of the war. So instead of being behind the scenes influencing the men, they went on the public stage themselves.
And you describe Washington at that time being transformed for women from a sleepy town where Southern Belles congregated and do whatever Southern Belles did to a place where purposeful women came to effect change. From both North and South, or were the Southern women, by the time the war started, barred from there?
Well, they left to join the new country of the Confederacy, but many of them stayed in touch with their friends in Washington and came back, if not to Washington to live, to visit and to lobby on a regular basis, and several of them ended up living in New York. So they were back and forth a good deal.
And one of the women you profile is Verena Howell Davis,
who's
wife
fabulous.
Of Jefferson Davis, who you call the First Lady of the Confederacy, but who had ambivalence about the war.
Very much so. She wrote to her mother before she moved to Richmond to assume her duties as the First Lady of the Confederacy, and she said to her mother, basically, we can't win this thing. We don't have the manufacturing. We don't have the railroads. Now, you'd think the men could have figured that out, too. But she said, I'll go and do my duty. But she was never fully engaged, and she was never fully accepted. Her grandfather had been the governor of New Jersey. She had gone to school in Philadelphia. She was not, in the same way Mary Lincoln was always suspect as a Southern sympathizer in Washington, Verena Davis was always suspect as a Northern sympathizer in Richmond.
And you mentioned Verena Davis's mother seeing Washington as a meritocracy.
Right.
And being surprised by that. I thought that was a really interesting reference.
Well, you know, it's still true. It's one of the things that's really nice about Washington. The currency is not money like it is here. It is...
Excuse me?
Well, it is.
In politics in Washington?
No, but politics in Washington, it's the currency is power. Now, to the degree that, you know, you need money to achieve the power, yes, but it's not the money you make. A member of Congress makes a great deal less than a lot of people in New York would think was an appropriate amount of money. But they are still more powerful because they hold the title. And that's still true.
My guest, if you don't recognize the voice, is NPR and ABC News political commentator Cokie Roberts. Her new book is called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. And we'll get to some current stuff in a minute. Let me go through one or two other things from the book. Were there any women in Congress at that point?
Oh, no, certainly not. No. Women couldn't vote, and married women, of course, couldn't even own property. They were the property of their husbands. So it was a time when women had no formal power, but they assumed it in a variety of ways.
What were the most common ways?
Well, the most common ways for women who were married to or related to prominent men was to influence the men. But they also, because they were considered influential, people came to them for patronage jobs, and they would then get them the jobs, and or to endorse products, those kinds of things, because the women were considered influential. And then the way that they did their influencing before the war particularly was through a series of social events where they wined and dined and talked and flirted and referred to themselves as belles, and they were very active socially, and it made a difference in terms of their men folks' lives. One of the most out front actually was here in New York at the time, and that was Jesse Benton Fremont. Her husband, John C. Fremont, who we think of as the swashbuckling pathfinder, the explorer, was the first Republican nominee for president in the brand new Republican Party in 1856. And they were living in New York in the lead up to the convention. And she was living just off Fifth Avenue. And she said, "Our neighbors see a presidentess among them. And I wear purple just to make sure they know it." But then when he was nominated, all of the propaganda was Fremont and Jesse. No one had a clue who the vice presidential nominee was. And she was very much out front.
And we'll talk about another potential presidentess a little more contemporary in a minute. But I want to touch on one other thing from the book, because you wrote in the book about women who were writers at the time.
Right.
And they don't get much history written about them. Was there a Cokie Roberts of the 1860s?
Well, there were certainly journalists. And one of the ones who I did, even though she was a bomb thrower and I'm not, but I did have a certain identification with her, was Jane Swisshelm, who came to Washington before the war and was the first woman to report out of the Capitol Press Gallery. But she was soon expelled from it for writing vicious truths, which was that she said that, you know, Daniel Webster was a drunk, and the male press corps was horrified. "We don't write those things." And I had very similar experiences when I started covering politics, when the men on the bus just thought that you didn't say what went on the bus. And that was not the view of the women.
My guest is Cokie Roberts. Her new book is Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. So how much do you see gender as a factor at this point in Hillary Clinton's success or failure as a presidential candidate? And how much is she just too well known as an individual, as herself?
No, I still think sex is a factor, absolutely. For many, many women, particularly women of a certain age, idea of not dying before there's a woman president is very appealing. And so I think that does go a long way. And if you look at the numbers, Brian, you know, as you well know from the Obama coalition, he did very, very well with young people, Hispanics, African Americans, Asians. But among white women, he did not. Hillary Clinton's polling very well among white women. If she can hold them, that really does help her enormously in terms of getting elected.
Do you think, this is a little politically incorrect, but by being the white person who was the last candidate standing against Barack Obama in 2008, and being able to run to that, you know, conservative-ish white working class population who was still registered as Democrats in 2008, helped her in that respect?
Not particularly. I mean, Obama lost the white vote big time, and I think it's very hard for Democrats to win the white vote pretty much anywhere, except in, you know, places that are just overwhelmingly Democratic. You look now at the House.
You're in one of them, right?
Yes,
now.
I'm aware. sometimes Boston also, you know, but the San Francisco, but the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives now is majority, minority, and female. So it really does reflect the Democratic Party as a whole.
I see you regularly get slammed on some of the conservative sites for seeming to downplay the importance of things like Hillary Clinton's emails and whether she's taking enough questions from the press, which was the issue this week. You think these things are overplayed?
What I think is that voters don't much care about them. That's what I say. I don't say that they're not important, but people don't vote on something like that. Now, if she gets into a complete sense of on the part of the public that she's not trustworthy, and that number is growing of people who say she's not trustworthy, or the people who think that she's just not someone that they're comfortable with, that's terribly important. That's what we vote for president. We vote for somebody that we think is going to make the right decisions for the next 4 years, because we know, and we're right about this, that we have no clue what the issues are going to be. We didn't know the Berlin Wall was going to fall. We didn't know Saddam Hussein was going to invade Iraq. You know, we didn't know the World Trade Center was going to be hit. All of those things. So what we do is we vote for the person we trust most, or at least trust more than the other guy, and it's always been Guy, to do the right thing. And if Hillary Clinton falls on that metric, then she won't be elected president.
What about donations to the Clinton Foundation posing conflicts of interest? How seriously do you take that?
I think that that's something that people really need to take a look at, but I think that's going on. I think the press is taking a look at that.
Here's all Clinton would say yesterday when she was asked about that by a reporter.
I am so proud of the foundation. I'm proud of the work that it has done and that it is doing. It attracted donations from people, organizations from around the world. And I think that just goes to show that people are very supportive of the life-saving and life-changing work it's done here at home and elsewhere. And I'll let the American people make their own judgments about that.
And I'll tell you, I asked former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who was here yesterday and who's a Republican by background. He served Democratic presidents, too, including Obama. He was Defense Secretary, as you know, first 2 years when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. If he ever saw her as having a conflict of interest because of donations to the Clinton Foundation, and he just basically say nothing he ever saw.
Well, Bob Gates and Hillary Clinton had a fabulous partnership, in fact. The country was well served with the two of them working in tandem. And what Bob Gates is so interesting about is the fact that he really does believe in soft power, smart power, whatever you want to call it. And is always, it's he, the former Secretary of Defense, the former CIA director, who's constantly saying, you know, it's ridiculous we spend less in foreign aid where we could do much more good than we do on military bands. And so having that voice was a very, very useful thing. But I think it would be, you'd be hard pressed to do a direct line from a donation to the foundation to a policy. But you know what, Brian, to be fair about that, you're hard pressed to ever do a direct line. You know, it's hard to do those, even in a case right. Where it looks like a real bribe to somebody, it's still not easy.
But that's the point on which I think Hillary Clinton just needs to be assessed in the context of all major politicians.
Absolutely.
Not like as some outstanding, oh, my God, they took money at the Clinton Foundation, when all of politics is so awash and all kinds of big money from interested parties.
Well, and the Clinton Foundation, I mean, her statement about the Clinton Foundation doing good work is absolutely correct. It does do good work. You know, it's did people think when they were from some foreign country giving the money that it might be helpful to them? Sure they did.
One other big story today. L.A. passes a $15 minimum wage. That's been the holy grail for fast food workers. Others, the activists have been saying $15, and they actually passed the full $15 in Los Angeles.
Phased in
between now and 2020, but it's under $9 in New York and New Jersey right now. So this is a big deal, no?
It's a very big deal if it happens. Of course, you heard this morning on Morning Edition the head of the Chamber of Commerce, a Hispanic in Los Angeles, saying that it's going to cost jobs. And, of course, that is always the argument. And it probably does cost some jobs. The opposition person said, well, in San Francisco it hasn't, but San Francisco is a unique situation at the moment. So you're just going to have to wait and see whether it does drive out some low-paying jobs for people. It's always the argument. You know?
We've got about 3 minutes left.
Oh, okay.
Remind us, when did you first start working for NPR?
I started working for NPR in 1977.
You were a congressional correspondent in the early days, right?
I was, yes. They actually hired me in 1978. They're never quick on this, you know, Brian. But, yes, and I covered Congress and politics for many, many years and still do.
So tell me, everyone decries the polarization in Washington today. Was there really a time, Cokie, when Democrats and Republicans got along and compromised for the good of the nation? Or is that false nostalgia for a thing that never really was?
No, there actually was a time, but it was a short period of time, and it was aberrant in our history. And it was the post-World War II time. And I actually had the experience interviewing President Ford, my last interview with him. He was minority leader when my father, Hale Boggs, was majority leader of the House. They were best friends. parents. I was a eulogist at Mrs. Ford's funeral. And so it was a different time. But I do think, Brian, it's because they literally were in foxholes together. And they knew that the enemy was not the guy across the aisle. It was the dictator across the sea.
And so it gradually faded after World War II. But people say it's worse now than they've ever seen it. But they also said that in the 90s. Remember how one of the reasons some people chose Obama over Hillary Clinton in 08 was to avoid the way Americans tended to polarize around the Clintons? Has the Obama era turned out to be more polarized than the era he was elected to end?
Well, I think American politics is more polarized. They voted for George W. Bush because he said he'd bring civility to Washington in 2000. And Al Gore represented the current Washington at the time. So I think that people yearn for it, but then keep electing politicians who are more polarized. It's not our most polarized time ever. That period was the period I write about in Capital Dames. But then we went to war, so we don't want to repeat that.
Cokie Roberts, NPR and ABC News commentator, and her new book, which is really fun and fascinating, compelling. I spent some time with it over the last day. Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. Thanks, Cokie.
Brian, always good to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest, Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist and author, has become known as well for his fiery rhetoric promoting his naturalistic view of the world. It's what fellow science personality Neil deGrasse Tyson calls Dawkins' articulate barbs at creationism in debates, and books such as The God Delusion that spurred the New York Times to call Dawkins the most famous atheist on Earth. But in his new book, Brief Candle in the Dark, My Life in Science, Dawkins takes a different approach to narrating his experiences in the field of scientific study, not so contentious. He joins me now to discuss this new book, and we'll also touch on some of the more notable news from the world of science, including maybe some of the past week's Nobel Peace Prize winners. Hi, Richard Dawkins. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
The title, Brief Candle in the Dark, is a line from Macbeth, isn't it?
Brief Candle is from Macbeth. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, and so on. The other half of the title, Candle in the Dark, actually comes from Carl Sagan. It's the subtitle of Carl Sagan's splendid book, The Demon-Haunted World. So it's both, in a sense, a meditation on the brevity of life, that's the Shakespeare part, and on the wonder of science, that's the Carl Sagan part.
Did you want this book to get away from your public persona as the world's most famous atheist and back into a retrospective of your actual work in science?
I did want it to be an honest account of my life, of the second half of my life, actually. This is the second of my autobiographies. The first one, An Appetite for Wonder, took me up to the age of 35, and that was sequential. But the second one, Brief Candle in the Dark, is a jumping around autobiography. It's deliberately not sequential. It deals with themes, and it contains digressions which are, frankly, humorous in many cases. I hope they're honest. I hope they're affectionate in many cases.
Your most famous work was probably The Selfish Gene, your most famous work in science. How do you look back on that today, or reintroduce it to the uninitiated in the audience?
Well, it's a tall order to reintroduce a whole book, but I wouldn't actually back down from anything I said in The Selfish Gene. It's about the gene as the unit of natural selection. It's about natural selection, but from a gene's eye point of view. And it's my belief that if you look at natural selection from the gene's eye point of view, you get the right answer and you understand what's going on, provided you can rid yourself of the error of thinking that I really mean genes are selfish. Of course, I don't mean that in the conscious sense. It's an analogy. It's a metaphor. But it's a metaphor that works, and it gives you the right answer.
And in Brief Candle in the Dark, you write that you hope your book, starting with The Selfish Gene, helped to kickstart the third culture. What is the third culture?
Well, it takes off from C.P. Snow's two cultures, the artistic culture and the scientific culture. The third culture is a phrase coined by John Brockman, the well-known New York literary agent and promoter of science. And what John Brockman has done is to put on a, is to create a kind of salon for scientists and intellectuals who take a scientific point of view and who talk about and argue about scientific issues, philosophical issues, usually from a naturalistic point of view, and try to meld, try to unite the two cultures.
And in the book, you write about what you refer to as the Concord fallacy, which you also discussed in The Selfish Gene. What's the Concord fallacy?
The Concord fallacy, it's known to economists as the sunk costs fallacy. It's the error that people make when they say we've already spent so much on a project that we can't stop now, because if we stop now, everything that we've spent so far will have gone down the drain. It gets its name from the Anglo-French airliner, the supersonic airliner, the Concorde, where when it became clear that it wasn't going to be an economically viable proposition, nevertheless, the British and French governments carried on with the project because they had already spent so much on it that to stop now would be to lose, to throw away all that they had so far invested.
Do you see examples of the Concorde fallacy taking place in science today?
Well, I brought it up in The Selfish Gene in the context of sexual investment, investment in children by parents, by females and males. And the Concord fallacy there was that the female sex has already invested so much in a child that it can't afford to stop now. And there were people in the literature, the scientific literature, who committed the Concord fallacy in evolutionary theory. It came up again in work that I was doing jointly with the biologist Jane Brockman and Alan Graffen, that digger wasps, it'd probably take too long to go into it, appeared to be committing the Concord fallacy.
What do you mean when you use the example of women investing so much in a child?
Well, I didn't say women. I said females. I was actually talking about birds. In The Selfish Gene. The idea there is that there's a kind of battle between the sexes. The chapter in The Selfish Gene is called Battle of the Sexes, and the idea is that since both partners are attempting to maximize their own genetic success, possibly exploiting the other, one of them might abandon the other. Probably more likely the male might abandon the female, leaving the female with what was called a cruel bind, faced with the option of should she rear the child on her own or should she herself abandon it. And the Concord fallacy would be to say she has already put so much into this child, this baby bird, that to abandon it now would be to throw away what she's already invested.
I see. Well, I'm glad it's in the context of birds, because otherwise I was imagining like mothers of 14-year-olds saying, oh, this kid is so annoying now in adolescence.
Yeah, just go. Yes.
Go.
Yes. Yes. So, when in doubt, I'm not talking about humans.
Richard Dawkins, Human, is the author now of Brief Candle in the Dark, My Life in Science. I want to get your take on some major news in a field of science that you've specialized in, because in your book you discuss your paper, The Genetic Book of the Dead, which assembles our ancestors' genes to tell a digital description of their environments. So I'm curious about your reaction to the discovery in September, or at least the announcement of that discovery in September, of a mass underground grave just outside Johannesburg, South Africa, known as the Cradle of Humankind, containing the remains of hundreds of individuals from what scientists say seems to be an entirely newly discovered species of the human family.
Yes, this is an exciting discovery. When Darwin wrote, there were really no human fossils, and so it was a conjecture on Darwin's part that Africa is the cradle of humanity. We now know from much fossil evidence that we are all Africans. We have only rather recently migrated out of Africa. Many of the most famous fossils have come from East Africa, but South Africa is also a very important part of the fossil history of mankind. And this latest discovery in a cave in South Africa is very exciting. There's lots of material there. It appears to be from the genus Homo, the same genus as us, but a different species, Homo naledi, and it's a very primitive member of the genus Homo, perhaps bordering on the previous genus Australopithecus. There's lots of material there. It's very well preserved. It's not dated yet, and nobody knows how old it is, but probably getting on for 2 million years.
But what does that actually tell us about who we are in a way that's meaningful to people today?
Well, I'm not sure that these particular fossils tell us anything special in themselves. They're part of the overall record of human fossils. The biggest change that's taken place in our fossil history in Africa is once we stood up on our hind legs, and we'd already done that by about 3 million years ago, then after that it was the swelling of the brain, the great increase in brain size. And Homo naledi, the New South African material, does have a relatively small brain compared to ours. So I suppose it's telling us that our ancestors were much smaller brain than us.
Nikki in Atlantic Highland, you're on WNYC with Richard Dawkins. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Dr. Dawkins.
Hello.
I just wanted to basically call in and say thank you so much for the work that you've done and for all the fantastic books you've put out. I can't wait to read this next one. And you've really made a change in the way that I view the world. And also, I'm a biologist. And so I just wanted to really say thank you for really bridging the gap here and really, I'm sorry, I'm very excited to talk to you. And I just wanted to say thank you for basically helping me with my decision making and for giving me the thoughts that I have. And so thank you.
Well, that's music to my ears. Thank you very much indeed.
Nikki, thank you. Thank you so much. Donald in Stamford, you're on WNYC with Richard Dawkins. Hi, Donald.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good, thanks for taking my call. So, Dawkins, how do you feel when someone has accomplished as Ben Carson, running for President of the United States, says that it takes as much faith to believe in evolution as it does in the Bible? Would you have any commentary around that, or...
Donald's line is breaking up pretty badly, but I guess you heard the question.
I did hear the question. It's an educational disgrace that a presidential candidate and a very distinguished doctor should display such extraordinary ignorance of science, not just science, but the science of his own subject. Since he's a doctor, biology is the foundation of his own subject, and evolution is the foundation of biology. And his statements have clearly show that he doesn't understand and doesn't know very much about the science of evolution. It's my view that doctors ought to learn about evolution because it is the foundation of biology. And in particular, Darwinian medicine, which is a term coined by Randolph Nessie and George C. Williams, is a very important branch of medicine which doctors need to understand and grasp rather more thoroughly than they do. So I recommend the book by Nessie and Williams. It's called Why We Get Sick, which is not a great title, but the subtitle is Darwinian Medicine. So I recommend this to doctors. It is, as I say, a disgrace that we have a leading presidential candidate who doesn't understand the fundamental science of his own subject of medicine.
Thomas and Darianne, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Nice to hear from you. I was just wondering for Professor Dawkins, what do you do when someone comes up to you and outright denies evolution, and how... What do you say to them? How do you change someone whose mind is so outright set in that opinion? How do you do that?
It depends how much time you've got. I mean, if you haven't got very much time, all you can do is say read a book, because they clearly haven't. If they think that, if there's time, then I would be very happy to explain some of the more important parts of the evidence. So the evidence is overwhelmingly strong. It's overwhelmingly convincing. Anybody who's not convinced by it simply hasn't examined it carefully enough.
And yet, despite the reputation you've developed for being confrontational in this respect, in the book you admit that you dislike the adversarial style of debating, as you put it. Have you always felt this way, or have you just become more magnanimous in your approach?
No, I mean, the book is a gentle, humorous book. I don't like the adversarial style of debating. It comes from the law. It comes from the idea of Anglo-American law, at least, as opposed to continental law, that the way to settle a question is to have a strong proposition and a strong opposition pushing in opposite directions, and then do a kind of tug of war to see which side wins. I'd rather have a civilized discussion, more like a court of inquiry. Let's look into this and let's try to decide what's really going on here. I prefer that way of dealing with it. So I don't think of myself as either adversarial or confrontational. And certainly in Brief Candle in the Dark, it is, as I say, a genial, humorous book.
Jose in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Richard Dawkins. Hi.
Mr. Dawkins, I'm a huge fan. Thank you so much for pretty much opening my mind to just being much more conscious of how I approach problems and questions. So first off, again, I wanted to commend you for your contribution. Second, I'm actually curious about your thoughts on maybe expanding your kind of science-centric educational mission to Latin America. I feel it's a region that has a lot of potential, but I can definitely tell from my peers and just even growing up in, for instance, I grew up in Puerto Rico, where the level of science and the approach is very different to that of my European and American counterparts, specifically the Anglo countries and the Nordic ones. So, yeah, I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, thank you very much. My books are all translated into Spanish and Portuguese. I've done a couple of big events in Mexico and in Brazil. And so I'm very interested in promoting evolutionary science in South America, Latin America. My foundation, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, is quite active in Latin America, and we are hoping to become more so.
Jose, thank you very much. By the way, here's a tweet from somebody. I guess in response to what you were saying about Ben Carson and other people who put belief in evolution at the same level as belief in creationism, tweeter says, "You cannot wake someone who is only pretending to be sleeping." Do you think there's a difference between people who really believe in creationism and a lot of politicians who take that position?
Well, yes, I suspect it's true that many politicians are not actually being honest when they pretend to be as religious as they are. I think it may be a bit of a myth in America that in order for a politician to succeed, they've got to pretend to be religious. All politicians believe this, and of the 535 members of the U.S. Congress, not a single one admits to being non-religious, which is a statistical nonsense. Obviously, some of them have to be. What this means is that all members of the U.S. Congress are either religious or liars, and that's a pretty poor lookout. One of the things that my foundation, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, is trying to do is the so-called openly secular campaign, which is to raise people's consciousness in America that there are many, many more non-religious people in America than people realize. We're doing this with YouTube videos and things like that, and we're hoping that politicians will finally tumble to the fact that they don't need to suck up to the religious lobby all the time. There is a very substantial, greater than 20%, non-religious lobby in America as well.
Let me end on this. And remembering that we started with you describing how the title of your book, Brief Candle in the Dark, is a mashup of Shakespeare and Carl Sagan quotes, you write about your longing to bridge the divide between science and literary culture. Do you believe that literary culture can be an effective tool in promoting science, or why even bother to bridge? What is the gap between literary and scientific culture, and what needs to be bridged?
I love poetry. I like to think that my books contain some prose poetry. I quote poetry a lot. I wrote a book in, I think it was 1998, called Unweaving the Rainbow, which is about the relationship between scientific and literary culture. And I do believe that science is a magnificent vehicle for literary work, for poetic work. I think that it's that of course there are other such vehicles, but science really is a matter of poetry. It really is wonderful, and it conjures up the deep, some people say, spiritual feeling that is one of the most important and one of the greatest features of the human spirit.
Richard Dawkins' new book is Brief Candle in the Dark, My Life in Science. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you very much indeed.
The Brian Lehrer Show is not live today, so we won't be taking your calls, but we thought we would take this opportunity to bring you some of our favorite recent conversations for this day after Thanksgiving, like the one coming up next with Brandon Stanton from Humans of New York about his time interviewing Syrian refugees. We should say that this was recorded before the terrorist attacks in Paris reframed the conversation to include the potential for refugees to be terrorists, the effectiveness of security screenings to discover such threats, and whether it's even worth the risk to take in refugees. So as you listen to this upcoming segment and place it in the context of the Paris attacks, we welcome you to share your thoughts on our Twitter page, at Brian Lehrer, or leave a comment on our show page by going to WNYC.org and clicking on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Brandon Stanton is the creator of the world-renowned blog Humans of New York, which now has more than 15 million followers, which is more than New York Times, by the way. Over the past 5 years, he has interviewed and photographed thousands of people on the streets of New York City, and the blog has continued to evolve. The interviews, however, have become much deeper, and the stories have grown longer and more intimate as they accompany the photos. His new book is Humans of New York Stories, and it reflects this evolution with some of the best material from the past 2.5 years and 100 longer and more in-depth stories that have not been previously seen or read on the blog. Brandon, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
And before we get into the new book, I do want to ask you about your most recent venture, which I mentioned before the break. You were just in Europe, I know, taking photos of refugees,
right,
speaking with displaced people, largely from Syria,
right,
now in Croatia and Austria and Greece. How was that experience?
Eye-opening, as always. The stories that I have learned from Syrian refugees have been some of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, of anybody that I've ever talked to. It's just amazing to me that there is this massive flow of people that is currently moving across Europe. And if you pick one of these people just completely at random, they will have the most tragically detailed story of violence and fear that you have ever heard. And each of them are unique in their own way. If you looked at my blog from those few weeks, it would almost seem like I stopped hundreds of people and cherry-picked the ones that had the most emotive or tragic quality, when in reality it was a completely random selection, and that is what every single person in that country is going through.
And I heard you from another interview say that the first question that you asked each Syrian refugee was, tell us about the day you left Syria.
Right.
Why that?
Well, because, you know, I think there's so much assumption that there is this broad range of motives that is causing these people to leave their homes, whether they be economic or anything like that. And from talking with these people, I realized that they did not want to leave. They had children. They had a home that they had built, they had saved for 20 years, and they were fighting it. And there was almost always something that happened that just broke their back, which forced them to grab one pair of clothes and leave with their kids on this dangerous journey. And to really get into what these people were going through, the most effective question that I found to lead with is, tell me about the day you decided to leave Syria. And what would happen is, I was speaking through an interpreter with Arabic. Almost always, the person would start talking in Arabic. They would talk for about 30 seconds. They would pause, and tears would start streaming down their face, and I had no idea what they were saying, but it happened every single time.
Because the underlying emotion was about having to leave home.
Right, and just this, and I mean, normally there was a murder of a family member involved, there was torture in prison, their house was burned down, their kid's friend was bombed in front of his face. You know, it was a sadness of leaving home, mixed with just the trauma of what caused them to leave.
If you're hearing stories like that over and over, I wonder if you were able, and I know this is not what you were after, this kind of sort of war analysis, but to get an idea of whether those murders were being committed more by the Assad regime.
That's a great question.
Or by ISIS or some other group.
It's so hard to identify good guys in that situation, because I heard horror stories from every side. Yes, the general consensus is that one man started it all. Most always the blame came back to Assad. If he hadn't have suppressed the protests violently, if he hadn't have killed his own people, these rebel groups wouldn't have formed. There wouldn't have been the vacuum that allowed them to prosper. So even though Assad is the number one man who is blamed by these refugees that I talked to, the Free Syrian Army, ISIS, and Assad, I talked to people that were terrorized by every single one of those groups. Mm.
And we can talk and talk and talk, but photojournalism, just photography, has so often been the most effective tool in garnering sympathy and outrage in all kinds of situations in the world. I'm looking here at one of the photos you took of a woman coming from Turkey. You took this photo in Greece. She's crying, covering her face. She's wearing a colorful headscarf. And the story that's attached to the image is so harrowing. It's about her passage on small, unsafe boats, or a boat which sank between Turkey and Greece. Do you know who I'm talking about?
You know that out of 5 years of photographing, that was the single most popular photo. And when I say
really?
Popular, that photo went into 72 million news feeds. Yeah, and just, I mean, and it shows you the power of her story and how much it connected with people. This is a woman who was on a boat that was going across the Mediterranean to Turkey. It was overcrowded. It was a boat that had a capacity for about 50 people. There were about 300 people piled onto this boat. It hit a rock and it started sinking. And she lost her husband in the middle of the ocean. She was rescued, but he was lost. And the story she told me were about the final moments she had with him in the water.
And to bring it back to New York and your new Humans of New York stories book, that woman from Syria, that's hardly the first time that you've harnessed your popularity to bring attention to something you found worthwhile. Like in January, you met and took a photo of a teen boy named Vidal who named his principal as his greatest influence. You want to tell us what happened next to him?
Yeah, that's probably the most epic 45-second story I'm able to tell. So I was in January. I was in the housing projects of Brownsville, Brooklyn, and the only person outside was this young man wearing a hoodie. He was about 14 years old. I stopped him, and in the course of conversation, I asked him, who has influenced you the most in your life? And he told me about his principal, Miss Lopez. So the next day, I went and interviewed her, and then spent the next 2 weeks telling the stories of the students and teachers at her school. We raised about $1.6 million to support their school, and at the end of the week, me, the young man, and the principal got to go to the White House and interview President Obama.
Wow.
So it was the craziest week of my life, yeah.
And you raised nearly $1.5 million for the school,
right.
Mott Hall Bridges Academy in Brownsville.
Right, right.
And in your book, you have a photo of Vidal and the principal and Obama in the Oval Office. So if people want to see it, you can get the book, Humans of New York Stories. And then on the following page, Obama gets the Humans of New York treatment with his own portrait and story.
Right.
So tell us about the photo that you chose of the president and the question you decided to ask him.
Well, we had about 15 minutes in the Oval Office, which is about the time period that you get. And I wanted Vidal to spend as much time with the president as possible. And I knew that the president was probably more interested in meeting the teacher and the student than me. So Vidal and I practiced the interview. Vidal actually helped me interview the president. So even though I took the photo, Vidal was the one that was actually asking the questions. And the question he asked the president was, who influenced you the most in your life? And the president told the story about his mother, who was fighting to get a PhD while raising them and while working. So it was a powerful story in itself.
That's great. Emily and Ossinen, you're on WNYC with Brandon Stanton. Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Brian. I wanted to mention that over the summer when my husband and I were in Chautauqua in western New York, we saw an exhibit of photographs from a photojournalist named Brendan Bannon, who's from Buffalo. And he has been working with young people in refugee camps in where there are Syrian refugees in Jordan and Lebanon, and teaching them he's been doing his own photojournalism. He's been teaching them photojournalism, basically, to document their lives in the camps. And there may be millions of people who are not making the trip across the Mediterranean, but who are living in in camps in Jordan.
Right, and it's
Lebanon.
True for all the publicity in this country that the European Syrian refugees get. There are so many more in Jordan and Lebanon.
Oh, yeah. I think the refugee camp Zaatari in Jordan has become the third largest city in Jordan. And I think that's what she was talking about.
Yes.
And there's great projects along the lines of what she's talking about of NGOs that have moved in there. And I've actually seen them where they are giving the refugee children cameras and they're going around and kind of documenting and interviewing other refugees. It's very interesting.
The future Brandon Stantons.
Yeah, hopefully.
Carol in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to thank your guest for his good work, because we in the United States are so used to identifying Middle Easterners with suicide bombers and terrorism and political machinations and whatever, that we forget that it is peopled by millions and millions of ordinary people who have nothing to do with that kind of activity whatsoever. And I, for one, think we need to start seeing them as people. I'm beginning to sound like Pope Francis, but my point is, remember, he spoke about that when he was here a few weeks ago. And I think if we started doing that, we might experience less backlash on our foreign policy. So I want to thank him for the wonderful work that he is doing. And the children of Syria need to be in school.
No, it's 100% true. And, you know, what you said is not only, you know, the Muslim population, especially overseas, is identified by so many people with militarism that it's often forgotten that it's the Muslim population in these countries that are suffering the most from this militarism. They're the ones that are seeing the violence firsthand and suffering from it, and they hate the violence even more than we do.
You know, the book, and Carol, thank you, is powerful in the way that it sort of mimics the experience of walking through New York if you walk with sort of an open, conscious mind. Because if you flip through it, it's a crowd of faces. But with your work, you get to talk to these people, something New Yorkers are often afraid to do to strangers, sometimes for good reason, you know, and something I'm lucky enough to do here, to have people call in from all corners of the area for all kinds of reasons. But I'm looking now at a picture from your book of a man who said he was surprised that you went up to him because no one ever goes up to him.
Right. You know, that was the man you're talking about is a man who has a weight problem, and he's struggled with it his entire life. And actually, the moment that I walked up to him, he was sitting there and kind of reflecting on this, and he was having a very bad day because he had just gone to the doctor, and he'd been working so long to lose weight, and he had just gone to the doctor, and he had gained a few pounds, and he was just very distraught about that. And, you know, that is one thing he said, that, you know, my weight isolates me. I like to go to movies alone. I like to go to restaurants alone. I don't want people to watch me or see me. And so he was thanking me for just coming up and having a conversation. And
that's a recurrent thing, though. You go up to people who are alone.
Yeah, because, you know, that's one of the things I look for today, is because I need time. You know, it used to be the first book, if you look at it, it's very photographic. It's very colorful and eccentric. And if you look at the second book, it's got 10 times more text because I've spent about 30 or 45 minutes with these people.
That's the point. That's why it's called New York, Humans of New York Stories.
Yeah, and the one thing that I am looking for is somebody I can talk to, which is normally someone alone that I have time to speak with.
Why did you decide, since you were already so famous as a photographer, to get more into text?
Well, you know, and it's just like I've never really seen myself as a photographer, and I don't really do. You know, I loved photography, and then I found this. I just love doing it. I've only been doing it for 5 years, but it was a thing I loved to do all day long. And through doing that, I started photographing people. Then I started having conversations with it. You know, I never made the decision I want to have this career or that career. I was just kind of following what I loved. And then when I started, you know, interviewing people, it wasn't a very far cry to, you know, start focusing on that, because I wasn't really seeing myself as a photographer. I was more seeing myself about that, like that weird dude who stops strangers on the streets of New York City. That was more my identity. And so I'm stopping them anyways. Why don't I spend time with them and find out who they are?
And just one more thing real quick, because we're over time. Sometimes you don't show people's faces.
Right.
Even though, again, that's what you're most known for, is taking pictures of people's faces. But it's because what they're up to might be embarrassing or not something they want to advertise, because their parents or significant other or boss can't find out. I'm looking at a series of pictures in your book of a girl but not of her face,
right.
her braid,
right,
her
right.
bag, her boots.
Right. Well, that was one of the, you know, most, I don't know if you want to say disturbing or raw stories in the book. This was a 21-year-old girl who had traveled to New York City without her parents knowing or her parents' permission to engage in a BDSM relationship with a 55-year-old married man.
Whoa.
And I happened to walk up to her while she was killing time while he was at work. And so it started with this sexual theme, with her talking about this kind of sexual reason she was in New York City. And then the 30 or 45 minutes I talked to her, suddenly we get into her past, and we find out all of this tragedy and this depression that she's going through. And even though she is engaging in this activity that is viscerally very stimulating, it is undermined in her. It is underpinned by this huge sense of isolation and hopelessness and suicidal thoughts. And so, yeah, it was a story that, you know, disturbed a lot of the audience. But
what
I think
do you do
important.
At the end of something like that? Leave her and say, well, thanks for the interview.
It's a fantastic question. It's a question that I'm faced with all the time. It's a question that I was especially faced with in Syria when I interview these people and all they have is one change of clothes and they've told me the saddest story in the world and suddenly I feel so connected with them and there's not much that I can do but tell their story. We raised money for the UNHCR. But beyond that, yeah, sometimes the limits imposed upon me as just somebody who is a storyteller can be very hard.
Well, with that heavy ending, we conclude with Brandon Stanton, creator of the blog Humans of New York and now the author of Humans of New York Stories. Brandon Stanton, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Judd Apatow joins us next. On WNYC, and for many of you, my next guest needs no introduction, but if you don't know, Judd Apatow wrote and directed The 40-Year Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People, and This Is 40, and was the executive producer of the cult hit Freaks and Geeks, and now HBO's Girls. He got his start working with funny people growing up on Long Island, and started interviewing the comedians he was obsessed by for a high school radio show. A collection of some of those interviews and more recent ones is in a new book, Sick in the Head, Conversations About Life and Comedy. Welcome to WNYC, Judd Apatow. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
And you start the book explaining your comedy obsession and giving a shout out to one of your Syosset High School teachers. Can you tell the listeners a little about that?
Well, I went to Syosset High School, and there was a radio station there, and it was run by a great man named Jack DeMacy, and he treated all of the kids like we were adults, and our radio station was this place where we could pretend we were in the real world, and I even interviewed a congressman in high school. I don't know what I asked him, and that's where I decided to do a radio show where I would interview comedians.
And I see your first interview with Jerry Seinfeld dates from then. He's in the news now for saying he won't even do comedy for college students because they get offended too easily. Do you think he'd do an interview for a teenage high school student today?
I hope so. I think it was a little different back then because there were no podcasts, there was no internet, and I don't think that many people were interviewing comedians. So I think when I asked, it was a rare event where now I'm sure he gets asked to do 50 things a day.
How about that complaint about young people today being too quick to take offense? Do you think audiences have changed or have comics who get too big gotten out of touch? Do you have an opinion about that?
I don't know what's the case with that, because I think there are people offended by jokes everywhere, but I think for the most part, young people, you know, they love South Park, they love Louie, and so they can take all sorts of jokes, but there's always a small percentage that is looking for a reason to be offended. But for the most part, I think they've been raised on a much harsher joke than I was as a kid.
In your interview with Key and Peele, I think Key says kids don't look at race, they look at culture. So a big generation gap in that respect?
I'm sure the experience of being a kid right now is so different than we ever could imagine. You know, my daughter, if she's into American Horror Story, she might watch the whole series in a weekend. I mean, it would take me years to get through, you know, MASH, you know, or The Odd Couple. But they're processing so much more information in a very different way. It's hard to even know what it's going to do to them, good or bad.
Here's a little of Key and Peele's take on code switching.
Jordan and I are biracial.
Yes, half black, half white.
And because of that, we find ourselves particularly adept at lying. Because on a daily basis, we have to adjust our blackness.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Oh, no, there's many reasons we do that. I mean, to terrify white people.
Yes, that's one of the main reasons.
Did they talk about that kind of thing with you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are, you know, as funny as it comes. And I was excited because in the book I got both Key and Peele and Amy Schumer. And I think they're the two or, you know, three most important comedians right now. And their sketches are, you know, shining a light on all sorts of important topics. And, you know, they're finding a way to be riotously funny and really attack certain injustices in a vicious way. So I love all of those.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. And I should mention that your new film is Trainwreck, due out in July, written by and starring Amy Schumer, who, of course, is getting so much praise and attention for her Comedy Central show and its no-holds-barred take on how women fare in the world. Here's a little of her stand-up act.
I'm supposed to want kids. I don't know if I do. I'm 30. I heard when you're a girl and you're 30, you're just like, I need a baby, but I just don't want to, like, make anything with my body. But it seems creepy, but no, I mean, I'm 30 years old. You know, I think it's because this is what I do for a living. You know, I get drunk every night. I'm pretty drunk now. Thank you. But no, but the girls I grew up with, they're living normal adult lives. So they call me now and they're like, Aim, I'm pregnant. And I'm still like, what are you going to do?
And in your book, Amy Schumer talks about how her stand-up is aimed at women almost as a service to help them deal with some of the anxiety and confusion that she experienced as a teenager over her looks and how much they mattered in the world. That idea of what from childhood drives comedians is a big line of questioning for you, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm always fascinated by. Is did something happen to you in your childhood that made you want to be funny? Because, you know, there are people who have had really brutal childhoods. You know, Richard Pryor grew up in a brothel, and it drives them to want to express themselves and talk about the things in the world that bother them. But then there's other people who are just really funny and smart and hilarious. And, you know, but that's, you know, someone like Jerry Seinfeld or Will Ferrell, and it doesn't seem like it's coming from a place of pain or injustice. So in the book, I'm always interested in asking people, what led you to want to do this?
Judd Apatow is my guest, if you're just joining us. His new book is Sick in the Head, Conversations About Life and Comedy. It's his Conversations with Comedians. And let's take a call from Emma in Manhattan. Hi, Emma, you're on WNYC.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
I can.
Oh, hi. I'm a really big fan of yours, too, Brian, but you just sort of articulated perfectly what I've always wanted. I don't know how you knew.
To ask Judd Apatow a question?
Yeah, and that he's never taken any of my invites to my dinner table.
Go for it.
I'm a little offended, Judd, but it's okay.
Go for it.
So I just wanted to ask you because, you know, you're such a great comedian with this range of sensitivity towards all these issues, and I'm this overly sensitive, politically correct, progressive millennial kid. So, you know, I wanted to ask you what you thought of that issue in your comedy. You know, does it stifle you to be so sensitive? Do you find that, you know, trying to find that human side to everything, does it affect your comedy? And also, I'm really nervous, so I'm completely suspense. And I really like your work, so thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I think that, you know, comedy in a lot of ways is supposed to talk about things that are difficult to talk about. And, you know, there's a bunch of ways to look at it. I mainly think if your heart is in the right place and the intention of your joke is an ethical one, you really should be able to say anything no matter how harsh. And people know what your point is if you've done it well. But some people think that the point of comedy is just to point out how harsh and ridiculous life is. So when something terrible happens in the world, they want to make the meanest, harshest, edgiest joke that seems awful as a way to almost like laugh in the face of the ridiculousness of our existence. And I get that kind of joke as well. And, you know, I think it's a matter of taste. I think people should be able to do anything. And if you don't like that kind of joke, you could, you know, listen to the comedian or see the movies made by the people who are more in your style. It's like a band. Some people like Nirvana. Some people like Garth Brooks. And it's all good.
Well, you know, on this show and on the station, through an event that our Arun Venugopal hosted in our performance space called The Green Space, an event called Funny or Racist, we've been having an ongoing conversation here about race and comedy. And one of the threads is that idea of the context for comedy mattering. And I wonder if, since you mentioned social media before, that can be harder to control than in the past. And I guess in general, do you think comedy is getting more contentious since your early days in it or being a student of it?
Well, in social media, it's difficult because people can't hear your voice. So if you're writing a joke in a tweet or something, there's always the potential for someone not to know what you're going for. Sometimes you'll email someone and they think you're being really mean, and you say, "Oh no, I was just asking you a question."
Mm-hmm.
That's why every time I email someone, I'll just use tons of emojis and exclamation marks just so they know I'm not angry. I'm just like, "Wee!" I just anything to let you know that it's not harsh. But I think with jokes, sometimes people don't know when you have your tongue in your cheek. That is a difficult place to make a certain type of joke. But, you know, people are supposed to fail. We're supposed to make bad jokes and as a way of having a conversation about things. So I don't think we should shut down the conversation just because somebody crosses the line. It's just language. It's just a sharing and a kicking around of ideas.
Jason in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC with Judd Apatow. Hi. Jason. Jason's so nervous he can't even ask his question.
Hello?
Hi, Jason.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. This is Jason. And I was just wondering, is Leslie Mann as funny in real life as she seems in your movies?
She's hilarious. She's my muse and my editor and inspiration.
And your wife, for people who don't know.
And my wife, and is a brilliant comedic actress. And you know, she's the greatest, and you know, it's been really fun to have the opportunity to work with her, and in the house, also funny, when she's feeling like it.
So what's it like when two really funny people live as husband and wife? Do you have to kind of gauge each other's moods as to when do you want to kid around and when do you want to be serious? And
I'm sure we're just like every other couple. You know, most of the time we're just, you know, dealing with the normal things of, you know, raising our two daughters and navigating, like, the madness of high school and junior high school drama.
You also talk to Chris Rock in the book, who stands by this classic from his act about being a father of daughters.
Sometimes I'm walking with my daughter, I'm talking to my daughter, I'm looking at her, I'm pushing her and stroller, and sometimes I pick up and I just stare at her, and I realize my only job in life is to keep her off the pole.
Some jokes don't get old generation to generation, right?
That's always true.
Steve Allen is, I guess, the earliest interview in the book. And with David Letterman's retirement, maybe you'd agree, he maybe got some credit for formula busting that Steve Allen was doing in the 1950s and 60s. Here he is outside his theater about to be run up a flagpole in a little cage, Steve Allen, in 1962.
Every night about this time, I wonder how I got into this. This flagpole runs up about 75 feet straight up, and I'm now going to run about 75 feet straight down Vine Street here. I'm not going to put up with this. You know, every time the gang gets me in one of these dangerous situations, I always act scared, but I do it. Well, tonight I'm not scared, and I'm not going to do it. Well, I guess I might as well go through with it. Now, do I hang onto this microphone when I go up in this little thing here? I guess I'm about as ready as I'll ever be. So, Somebody try to keep me away from the high tension wires, and we're in business. How do you do, sir? Oh. Look, up in the air.
Huh. So Chris Rock was trying to keep his daughter off the pole, and Steve Allen was avoiding going down. But 1962, and that really was pretty Letterman-esque, don't you think?
Oh, I think Letterman would be the first person to talk about all the amazing groundbreaking work Steve Allen did. I think, because a lot of things are in black and white and they're not that accessible at this point that, people don't get to see these things to know how riotously funny Steve Allen was. But he did do, an enormous amount of the things that people think other people invented. But he also, he was the only guy who had Lenny Bruce on his show a whole bunch of times.
Yeah.
And he pushed a lot of jazz artists and early comedians. And he's one of the all-time greats. And I was lucky to get to talk to him when I was 15 years old.
Wow. To get serious for a minute, the proceeds from your book, I see, go to Dave Eggers Tutoring and Literacy Nonprofit, 826. Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Sure. I met Dave Eggers many years ago and have done a lot of live concerts where the money goes to his charity. We did one in L.A. It was just a weird variety show. It was Pee Wee Herman, Bob Newhart, RZA, Colin Quinn, Ray Romano, and Peter Frampton.
Wow. Peter Frampton? Which one does not belong?
So we would do all these really fun variety shows. And then we were talking about all these interviews I have been doing since I was 15, and I said, maybe we could put them in a book and give you guys all the money. And that book is Sick in the Head. And it's, it's not just about comedy. It's also about the emotional journey that all these people, like Amy Schumer and Lena Dunham and Louis C.K., have been on. And I think if you're a fan of comedy or just a fan of creativity, it's a great book.
Why do you think Girls has been such a success?
Well, I think, we need very bold female voices. For whatever reason, it's been a male game for way too long. And I think people like Lena Dunham, Tina Fey, Mindy Kaling, Amy Schumer, there's a bit of catch-up happening right now. And hopefully it'll even out and just stay that way because, they have a lot to say. There's a lot of inequality right now that is disturbing, and it's great that funny people get to call it all out and to just be honest about their lives.
So what happens in somebody's brain, let's say yours, to take a random example, that makes you go from doing stand-up yourself and writing jokes to becoming an executive producer of what seems like every comedy film and TV show out there?
Well, I'm a fan of comedy. And so when I was a kid, I would watch Saturday Night Live and wish I could be a part of it. And in a way, what I do is create little families that make things. Sometimes we're all joining forces to make Knocked Up or Bridesmaids or Girls. And I love that collaboration. I love to be there when the spark happens. And it's fun for me to help people execute their ideas in addition to trying to figure out what my own ideas are.
And we have to leave it there. Judd Apatow's new book is Sick in the Head, Conversations About Life and Comedy. Thanks a lot. I really, really appreciate it. This was great.
Thank you so much.
The Brian Lehrer Show is not live today, so we won't be taking any calls. But we thought we'd take this opportunity to bring you some of our favorite recent segments. So enjoy, and remember that our comments page is always open. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. We have a rare opportunity today to speak with a doctor from Doctors Without Borders, who has worked in a combat zone and is now president of Doctors Without Borders USA. These are incredible heroes. You remember that earlier this month, a hospital run by Doctors Without Borders in Kunduz, Afghanistan, was hit by a U.S. airstrike, killing 22 people, including 10 patients and 12 staff members. The U.S. military said the attack was a mistake, but the circumstances surrounding the airstrike, which involved U.S. and Afghan forces targeting Taliban members who were being treated at the hospital, are contested. Doctors Without Borders itself says the airstrike wasn't a mistake and was a violation of the Geneva Convention. The organization has always held a neutral position in conflicts, treating victims on both sides of a war. And that got us thinking here at the Brian Lehrer Show about the complex dynamics and logistics and morality of treating fighters on opposing sides in a war zone. And we're very happy that the president of Doctors Without Borders USA, Dean Marchbein, who has herself been a doctor in war zones, is willing to come on now and talk to us about this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So you've worked in war zones and treated fighters on both sides of a war yourself?
Absolutely. I've worked in Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, DR Congo, South Sudan.
What a life.
It's important work, and I'm have the privilege of doing it.
So let me get right to a moral question. Is it always right, in your opinion, to be neutral in your work? The U.S., for example, is trying to kill people deemed to be terrorists bent on attacking civilians.
So there are basic rules of war that make it possible for everyone to be treated. Let me extrapolate from war to the United States. For more than 20 years, I worked in an inner-city hospital. There were serious bad guys who came in every Saturday night from the Knife and Gun Club, and no one ever asked me whether they deserve care or whether I should judge their actions before they came in the hospital. That, by international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, that is true in war zones, too. The moment that someone is injured, they become a patient and not a combatant, regardless of how they were injured.
And you think there's a total moral equivalency there between gangs on the street in a city and Taliban fighters or ISIS fighters in contemporary wars?
I'm a doctor. I took a pledge of medical ethics, and my pledge says that I will treat people without regard to their race, ethnicity, political origin, or their politics, and I will treat them according to their needs. So that is a basic rule of medicine,
value.
And it's a pledge that I took that I believe strongly in.
My guest is Dr. Dean Marchbein, president of Doctors Without Borders USA. And listeners, do you have a question for the president of Doctors Without Borders USA about the organization in general, or about the moral question or practical concerns about being neutral in a war zone? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. To maintain neutrality, are there steps that you have to take? Are there personal or institutional steps that need to be taken in order to carry out what you just expressed are the rules and the values of your work?
Absolutely. You're not neutral and impartial just because you say you are. You have to demonstrate it, and you have to negotiate for that space every single day. And that's what we do. So, for instance, when I was in Syria, there is a logo on top of the hospital that says it's MSF, which is, since everyone knows that it's a medical humanitarian organization, that means it's a hospital space. It's a protected space. But also, when people come in the door to be treated, they leave their arms. And when I was in the Congo, we were really on the front lines of a civil war. And we were treating both sides. Often you had injured people from both sides of that combat side by side in bed. And they all understood that really their only access to health care and their only access for their mothers and their sisters, because, by the way, it's not just the combatants that are injured in a conflict, it's the population. And in order for the whole population to have access to health care, there's a need to respect that. And there's an understanding that if they do not respect it, then MSF can't work and will pull out, and then there will be no access.
So you're saying there's a rule on wounded combatants or civilians that they need to leave their weapons outside to get treated at an MSF, Doctors Without Borders facility.
Absolutely. Let me share an anecdote with you about our work in Libya. I was the putative prison doctor following the fall of Gaddafi in Misrata in Libya during that war. And MSF had first come to Libya across the Egyptian border and had basically followed the rebel movement east because the Gaddafi government didn't want anything to do with us. And so for a time, we were, by virtue of our positioning, only taking care of one side. But we kept on saying to the people that we were treated and the people who were leading them, we are neutral and impartial and need to have access to both sides. We understand that they're wounded on the other side and we'd like to take care of them. And by virtue of our having been there and having insisted on our principles, ultimately they said, okay, we have these prisons full of people. You can take care of them. And so by virtue of having this constant dialogue and insistence on our medical humanitarian principles, we were able to get access to these patients.
And Mike in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, a very sad commentary, Brian. I have many doctors in my family and I realize the work they do. But shouldn't this group, Doctors Without Borders, right now, since Obama apologized to them in Afghanistan, shouldn't they take the lead to prosecute Obama and work in criminal court to set a precedent for the leaders that you can't solve all the problems of this world?
Mike, thank you for your question. I'm going to leave it there for time, but he's asking a specific question. President Obama did apologize to Doctors Without Borders.
And we are very appreciative of that apology and the apparent willingness of the United States to go forward with an investigation to understand. And until we have that investigation and understand what happened, why it happened, why the lines are being blurred between civilian and military targets, we cannot feel safe and we don't know how we can operate not only in Afghanistan, but in other conflict zones around the world.
So Doctors Without Borders left Kunduz after that incident. Are you saying there are other conflict zones around the world that you don't feel that you can operate in, that you have been operating in up until now because of that attack?
So, for instance, in Syria, there was a period of time when we were able to have international staff inside of Syria. There have been bombing and targeted attacks on hospitals, health structures, ambulances, medical personnel inside Syria. And right now, we are working on the periphery of Syria, which is it's a sad statement because Syria is one of the biggest humanitarian catastrophes of the decade, and we're not able to be inside.
Manny in Cornwall, you're on WNYC with the president of Doctors Without Borders USA. Hello.
Yes, first off, got to say hello to Grandma in Brooklyn. Second off, I'm a contributor to Doctors Without Borders, and I feel that they do very important work. Do you think by you guys taking this particular position that maybe your funding is going to go down in the United States because, you know, people might feel a little bit contrary to how you are, you know,
criticizing the U.S. government for the attack?
So first of all, thank you, Manny, for your support. We really appreciate it. We are not singling out the U.S. government. We speak out broadly when health structures are attacked. We've spoken out in Syria, in Sudan, in South Sudan, in Nigeria, in the Central African Republic. And this speaking out is not specifically targeted at the U.S. government. We're not anti-U.S. What we are is pro being able to work in a conflict zone. And unless the rules of law and war and the Geneva Conventions are respected, our work is imperiled in every conflict zone around the world.
If the position is that that attack in Kunduz was a war crime, would you, to our first caller's other question, testify, would Doctors Without Borders testify, if that's how it works, at some kind of international war crimes tribunal?
So I can't answer a speculative. The first job is to get the facts out. And that's what we're calling for, is a full accounting and an investigation. And until we know that, we really don't know that a war crime has been committed. We don't know who is at fault. But the idea that this is just an unfortunate event, when we know that the bombing was targeted, continuous for almost an hour, despite calls to Washington and to Kabul, and despite clear marking of this as a hospital structure.
To get back to treating combatants on both sides and the neutrality of the organization and your work personally in that regard around the world, what are the logistics of housing enemies in a hospital? You talked before about a case where people fighting on opposite sides were in side-by-side beds once they got into the hospital. Do you try to establish different wings for the different groups to avoid conflict in the hospital, or what do you do?
So it depends on the setting. If in certain settings we've been obliged, because of the large number of casualties, to set up tents, our hospitals are not like U.S. hospitals. There aren't private rooms. They're big wards. We have a limited amount of space and resources. So by virtue of that, often people are side by side, regardless of their preferences and ours.
And have you had any kind of humanizing moments where one side's wounded combatant was next to another side's wounded combatant in a hospital room, and they basically found each other to be just human beings?
I don't know that I've had that personal experience, but I know that I have been asked by patients about our independence, our funding. Again, in Afghanistan, I worked in Afghanistan at our maternity hospital in Khost, and I had the opportunity to talk to the staff, and they were very, very interested to know where our funding came from, whether I was directed by the U.S. government about what I could do and could not do. And it was really an important part of our ability to work there and my ability to work there effectively, that I could say that I could demonstrate why we were independent and how we were neutral.
So once you enter a region, you meet with local tribal leaders or other leaders to discuss Doctors Without Borders' role and pledge neutrality?
Absolutely. So we meet with local stakeholders, whether they're religious leaders or political leaders or women's groups, to actually have a discussion about what services they need. So in the case of the maternity hospital in Khost, it was the local community that said they needed a maternity hospital. In Kunduz, it was established that what they needed was a trauma center. And the neutrality and the impartiality, there is someone called the field coordinator, and that person's sole job is to manage the team and to reach out to the community to understand what they need, what they want, and to defend the MSF position and help people understand what it is.
With all the places in which you've worked, have you ever come up, despite the values that have that you've articulated so clearly, any ambivalence about, like, wow, these are some really evil people who got hurt this time, and I'm treating them the same as I'm treated, as I've treated, quote, the good guys?
I think that,
or the innocent.
I think that sometimes there's an expression, are you with us or with them? And I've heard that, and I think it's sometimes very, very difficult for people who feel passionately and are living in a war zone, whose families are at risk, to really fully buy into the MSF neutrality. It's my obligation of, as someone who comes from outside, to insist on that, because that is the only way that we're able to work.
Tell me again some of the countries in which you've worked personally as a physician in war zones.
So, Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, DR Congo, Ivory Coast. I think that's it.
Why do you do it? Why do you think your colleagues do it? They could live much safer lives being doctors with all their training in their home countries.
I have a skill that's needed, and I feel very privileged to be able to do that work. It's important work. Someone has to be able to do it. I have the privilege of being able to go there and do it. And I think that most of my colleagues feel that way.
Dean Marchbein is president of Doctors Without Borders USA. Thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. There was an article in the New York Times in May that was widely shared called Infidelity Lurks in Your Genes. Did you read it? The article basically said that for some women, the desire to cheat may be linked to a genetic disposition. Really? There are all these stats out there, like 90% of Americans think cheating is wrong. That's more than condemn polygamy. And yet studies seem to show that 20 to 50% of both men and women who are married do cheat. So 90% of us say it's wrong, and 20 to 50% of us do it anyway. Joining me now to discuss this is Anna Sale, host of WNYC's podcast, Death, Sex, Money, which aired an episode all about cheating. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Brian.
So you devoted this episode to cheating. Actually, it was a Valentine's Day episode, right?
I think it came out in March. We weren't quite so cynical to have it come out on Valentine's Day.
Good. I'm glad you're not that cynical. Here's a clip from that episode, a sampling of people who confessed to you that they were cheaters.
I started having an affair about 2 weeks into the marriage, which makes me sound like the most horrible person in the world.
It is one of the most isolating and lonely experiences.
This is the only way that I find comfort.
Actually, don't feel a lot of guilt about it.
Don't do it. Just don't do it. It's a terrible idea.
So let me dispense with the gender thing off the bat, because this call-in is going to be primarily for women. But did you find a gender difference? Like, the stereotype would be, and my impulse would be to think, okay, men cheat because they think somebody's hot and they can't resist, and that woman is willing. Women cheat for other reasons that are more emotional.
That's the stereotype, of course. And I should say, when we put this episode together, it was based on stories that we got from listeners. So it was about people who are willing to self-report to Death, Sex, and Money and to write in. And overwhelmingly, both people who had had stories about being cheated on or who had cheated, we heard from women. We only heard from one currently cheating man and said, I'm cheating on my wife. He confessed to it in an email. We wrote back and said we'd like to hear more, and then he disappeared. So
in other words, women, in your, you know, non-gender specific appeal, women cheaters were more likely to come forward.
Were more likely to come forward and to want to talk about the source of the impulse to cheat.
Which tended to be relational?
It tended to be a whole combination of things. I think what was interesting about the New York Times Sunday Review piece is it said the reasons we think infidelity happens is because of family history or a history of bad relationships or you know, some kind of social thing that's happened to you as you're growing up. And so opening the question of whether there's some genetic predisposition sort of changes that conversation. But what I heard from women cheaters in particular was one interesting story was about a woman who was in her late 30s, turning 40, had two kids, had been married for 20 years, and she described this overwhelming feeling that came to her in midlife that I've lost kind of autonomy of my body. I've lost this feeling of agency. Everyone has needed so much from my body that cheating was a way to reclaim some of that.
Let's take a call. Rachel in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What are you thinking?
So I have been in a series of long monogamous relationships since I was like 15. I'm now in my mid-30s, and I've cheated on everyone that I've ever been with. And a couple of years ago, I ended up, like, it had always been a lot. I had always kept it from my partners and felt really conflicted and horrible about that. A couple of years ago, I confessed, and like the feeling of relief and release in my relationship was really incredible.
Confessed to who?
To my partner.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and it really opened up a dialogue between us that became really meaningful. But it didn't stop cheating from being difficult for our relationship. So this happened. It happened again recently, and it was just as difficult. It was just as hard for us. And I think it's going to be the end of the relationship. But I was really amazed at the feeling that happened, just the physical and mental feeling that happened when I did it. It was like a complete and full body, like.
You mean when you disclosed rush. When you disclosed it, or
when
you cheated?
When the actual cheating happened. Yes. Yeah, the way that I can describe it is like what I imagine like a really hard drug would be like or something. You know, it's just like an incredible rush.
So why be in a primary relationship? Is that a fair question? You know, why not just be somebody who says, well, I don't want a monogamous relationship and have multiple relationships?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about that and talking a lot about that with my partner, and I think that the answer might end up being that I can't be a person who's in a long-term relationship, but I've been in long-term relationships. I love people very much, you know, I'm like very open, I just end up in them for whatever reason.
Because you also like the closeness.
Yeah, yeah.
Anna?
I'm just curious, when you said this is a pattern that you've recognized in yourself, where do you think it comes from?
I don't know. I think I connect very easily to people, and it's easy for me to slide into a very close kind of relationship that does sometimes end up being sexual. I think it's like part of my personality.
Did you read the Times article by any chance?
I did, yeah. I just read it this morning. When I saw that this was going to be your topic, I went and read it. I was really amazed by the comments, actually. There was a lot of
like
contentious
what?
Comments. Well, a lot of women coming forward and saying, why is there this double standard? This doesn't make any sense. And a lot of men coming forward and saying, you know, kind of a similar thing, like men cheat, but why, you know, why do they expect any different from the women that they're with?
Rachel, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate your candor.
Thank you.
Emily on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So you're going to do a true confession here, too?
Yes. Well, I'm calling because I am happily married. I have two children. My husband is stunning, and he is a wonderful, kind man. But I have thought about cheating, and it's only because I crave being praised and being the center of attention, because like I work so hard, you know, I'm taking care of the kids, taking care of the family, but there's no praise there. Nobody's there saying, oh, you did a good job, or oh, wow, you're so amazing. But then when you get that affection, that attention for me, I like men. So when I get that attention or that affection from men, it's just like, it's like affirming how great I am. Not that I think that I'm so great, but it just is giving me that positive feedback that, you know, my husband isn't always able to give me, or my kids obviously can't give me.
Could you tell your husband, darling, I really love you, I'm happy in our marriage, and I think you're awesomely attractive, but I would like some more, and I know you appreciate me, but I would like to hear it more in words out of your mouth. And if he did it, would that take away your interest in potentially cheating?
You know, I have had that conversation with him, and he has then made more of an effort. But, you know, we've got two young kids, a dog. My husband works a ridiculously long work schedule, and he travels often. And it's just the circumstances don't allow him to do that always.
So go ahead.
Oh, and in terms of it being genetic, I would definitely say that it's genetic, because my mother also needs that praise from others to feel good about herself. And
did she cheat on your dad?
Yes, she did. And my grandfather, my mother's mother, he was a major cheater. And so I just feel that a lot of times, and not to get into a psychology session, but I just feel that I
I assess my self-worth based on what other people think of me. And by having somebody physically attracted to you and...
Yeah, and when something is new, they're affirming, right?
Exactly.
I just wanted, it's interesting that you brought up genetics because as you were first describing it, it was very much a situation of the context that you're in right now of having two small kids, a harried life, a husband who's got a job that takes him away a lot. But your self-awareness that you get this jolt of good feeling from male attention that you don't get elsewhere is interesting. Did you have the inclination to cheat before you had the two small kids and the husband who was?
You know, I did. That's funny that you mentioned that because I did do that. I've always enjoyed the attention of men, and you know, been in relationships before where I just like getting the attention, and I didn't cheat, but it was just that thought was there. You know.
Have you ever thought about saying to your husband, I need something else, but I don't want to betray you, so I want to tell you that I might.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? It's funny. I don't think I ever actually would do it. But the thought is, like, you know what I mean? There's a big difference between actually thinking I might do it and having that thought of wanting to do it.
Yeah.
So I've got way too good of a thing going on to mess it up with that, you know?
Emily, thank you so much. Good luck to you.
Okay, thanks for your time.
And your whole family, I appreciate it. That question you just asked, Anna, did anyone in your segment on Death, Sex, and Money say exactly that, that they had disclosed to their husbands that they were thinking of cheating? Because, boy, as Emily suggested, not wanting to mess up a good thing, would even that stir the pot without actually having had the sex?
I don't think we heard any stories of someone saying, we've talked about, I'm feeling this urge, but I want to talk to you about it first. It was more we heard stories of people who came to that realization after going through the emotional carnage of cheating and realizing the sense of betrayal that comes about when it's discovered or when it's confessed. And so I think that that's a really important distinction to make when we're talking about cheating. Cheating is not necessarily sex outside of a marriage. Cheating is lying and betraying.
I'm thinking about our first caller and what she said, and I'm looking at the clips of the women from your episode, and there's one that is uncannily, like, exactly the same. So this is Sherry. You say Sherry or Sherry?
Sherry, it's not her real name.
Sherry, not her real name, confessed to you that she had an affair, and for her it seems like there are an array of factors that led her to stray, but listen to how similar this is going to sound to our first caller.
Well, so there was a lot of different things going on. I describe it now as sort of this awful, you know, hurricane. So I turned 39 and my kids got older and I lost all this weight. And suddenly this question started coming up about who was actually in control of my physical self, because it felt like for a long time, of course, it was my kids. And for all of my adult life, it was presumed to be under the control in a lot of ways of my husband. And at the same time, we did start to have sexual problems. He was turning me down a lot, which was not okay. And so all of that was sort of happening at the same time. And in the middle of that sort of hurricane, there I stood, and in stepped, you know, this wonderful distraction.
And actually, let me correct what I said before the clip. I guess that didn't remind me of the first caller, but one of your previous answers. So I guess you were describing Sherry.
Yeah.
But this idea of who's in control of her body. Her kids were in control of her body, and her husband was in control of her body.
And that she described the man she had an affair with as a wonderful distraction. And she said very little else to me about what she was sort of emotionally connected to about this other guy. It was so much about what she felt like she needed, not what this man was bringing into her life.
Let's do one more call. TK in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, TK.
Hey. My goodness, I'm shocked I made it through. I just want to put out a disclaimer before anything. I grew up being involved in my cheating.
Being involved. Sorry, your phone cut out for a second. You grew up being involved.
Being
what?
Involved in my mother's cheating.
Okay.
Meaning
you were helping to facilitate it?
You know, she would have me with her, and I knew that she was cheating. And this was at a young age, like 8, 9. So I told her I would never do that. You know, I would never cheat.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't yet, but I'm in this relationship. I love this woman so much. She loves me, so she says. I believe that she loves me. But the intimacy, the emotional, she's just cold. And I know she's been through a lot. She's been, you know, early trauma in her life. And I know that that has affected her. And I guess that's the reason that I don't know how else to put it, put up with it. You know, put up with the lack of intimacy. And it's not sex, because we have sex. It's just, I don't know. I mean, I'm used to having somebody's hand on my head. You know, I'm used to having, like a puppy. I'm used to having my belly rubbed.
You're the puppy. You're the puppy.
Yeah, I'm the puppy. You know, I'm the puppy. And I can't get my belly rubbed from her. And I don't know if I ever will.
Would there be another one who might rub your belly? Or is it only through affairs that you would have that particular experience eventually after any length of time in any relationship, you think?
Well, I've had my belly rubbed before in a relationship, you know. And as a matter of fact, that's what I'm used to. So the idea of cheating...
Right.
It's foreign to me.
So maybe you're with the raw, and everybody understands we're using having your belly rubbed metaphorically. But maybe you're just with the wrong person.
But I don't, it's so hard to imagine that I am, because I've never been with anybody that knew me as well as this woman.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been with anybody that I felt as comfortable with as I am with this woman. You know, it's not like there's not love there.
Well, I think what it's interesting to hear you're so clear. You saw as a young kid that you didn't want to cheat, and now you're experiencing what sounds like, you know, love that you want to have in your life, but realizing there's some parts that aren't being met. You know, I think that's why these conversations about cheating get so complicated.
Right. And TK, thank you for sharing. I hope everything works out. Did you hear from gay couples?
You know, it was really interesting. I say in the episode we heard from no gay men who had stories about cheating. We heard from a number of lesbians, women who were in relationships with women, about cheating. And when I said we heard no stories of cheating from gay men, then we got a whole other second wave of stories of cheating from gay men. But that's, of course, the stereotype, and what Dan Savage will say, is that gay men have a different vocabulary around what relationships can look like, and that monogamy is not necessarily always the default, that there's a more open conversation about
right.
how the relationship could work.
So bottom line, Anna, I'm not sure that the Times article changes the conversation that much, except at sort of a level, an intellectual level that's kind of a few layers up or down from, you know, what people are actually experiencing. So people have the kinds of conflicts that we've been hearing in this segment. And then, you know, maybe like the one caller we heard, some people have more of a genetic tendency than others to actually act on that thought about cheating, like her mother did and her grandmother did. Other people are saying, well, I have the impulse for the same reason as the other callers, but I can't imagine doing it. And that's what we learned from the Times article, that some people are just more genetically predisposed than others, or anything more.
I think it does change the conversation in an interesting way, in that if you don't think it's a moral flaw that you have this, you know, if it's not something that you acquired or that you were bad at one relationship and you're bad at another relationship, and you can just work really hard to figure out how to right this, you know, I was thinking of it like an analogy to addiction. You could be genetically predisposed to addiction. That doesn't mean there aren't very serious consequences for, you know, indulging in addiction, but it puts on your shoulders this responsibility to communicate that I think this is part of my makeup. And as a result, you as my partner, I'm going to tell you that this, I think, is part of my makeup. And that I think, could do a lot to, you know, cheating is destructive, and it's not okay. It hurts people. And so that's different from sex outside of a marriage. It's about communication and honesty. I think that's what I learned from the episode.
Anna Sale hosts our Death, Sex, and Money podcast. Can people sign up for this podcast at WNYC.org or wherever they get their podcasts?
You can. You can find it at WNYC.org. You can also find us at DeathSexMoney.org. That'll take you directly there, and you can see all of our episodes.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks to all of you for listening. And on this day after Thanksgiving, I want to thank the team that works behind the scenes on the show and all the interns who have helped us out over the past year. The show is produced by Lisa Allison, Mary Eileen Croak, Shamita Basu, Jorte Sena, Zoe Azoulay, and Megan Ryan, our executive producer. Our interns were Megan Malloy, Sam Anderson, Tess McRae, Cece Chen, Megan Kinane, Chinwe Onaya, Lola Loenig, Alexander Tin, Zashan Gundal, Hannah Dickison, Kritika Roy Chowdhury, Nishant Makija, Tiffany Green, Rebecca Giever, and Angie Voiles. I'm Brian Lehrer on WNYC.